I didn't hear any claim of a retaliation on a huge hack.
The Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on recent cyber attacks. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, January 5th. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, under a new administration, renewed efforts to build a King Cove Road.
Which I've just talked to the Secretary Zinke, and I think we can do that administratively, but I've introduced a bill.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
In the Senate Armed Services Committee, Alaska Senator Dan Sullivan has been a consistent voice warning about the Russian threat, particularly when it comes to Russia's military buildup in the Arctic. But at a hearing on cyber hacking today, Sullivan focused on hacking by other countries and didn't discuss Russia at all. APRN's Liz Ruskin reports.
Before we begin, I want to welcome all our members.
The subject of the hearing was foreign cyber threats. Senate Armed Services Committee Chairman John McCain made Russia and its pre-election hack the focus.
There's no escaping the fact that this committee meets today for the first time in this new Congress in the aftermath of an unprecedented attack on our democracy.
For the Arizona Republican and other senators, this was a chance to push back at President-elect Donald Trump. Trump has publicly scorned the U.S. intelligence agencies for concluding, as they have, that Russia hacked American email systems to interfere with the presidential election. Senator Lindsey Graham, a South Carolina Republican, says Trump should reconsider his disparagement of the intelligence agencies and hit Russia hard for what it did.
So I want to let the president-elect know that it's okay to challenge the intel. You're absolutely right to want to do so. But what I don't want you to do is undermine those who are serving our nation in this arena until you're absolutely sure they need to be undermined. And I think they need to be uplifted, not undermined.
When it was Senator Sullivan's turn to question the intelligence witnesses, he said nothing about Trump or Russia. Sullivan focused instead on the threat from North Korea, Iran, and China.
But I didn't hear any claim of a retaliation on a huge hack, a huge, 22 million American federal military intel workers got hacked by the Chinese.
Sullivan's main point was that the U.S. hasn't responded forcefully enough to foreign computer breaches and has become, as he puts it, a cyber punching bag. Afterward, Sullivan said he had Russia questions, but by the time he spoke, most had been asked already. And Sullivan says the topic has been politicized.
You know, I think there were some people, I don't think, I watched that there were some people who have been using the Russia hacking issue as a way to try to delegitimize the results of the November election. And what was clear today was that, you know, Donald Trump and Mike Pence won fair and square.
National Intelligence Director James Clapper testified that the intelligence community has no way to gauge whether Russia's hack influenced how Americans voted. Sullivan says it's important to look at what Russia is doing, but he, like McCain, says he doesn't see evidence that hacking determined the election outcome. Sullivan, though, says he doesn't dispute the intelligence chief's conclusions that the hacks came from Russia and were an attempt to interfere with the U.S. election.
No, I mean, you watched the hearing today, right? They were quite definitive on that. And they're the experts, and I don't have a reason to doubt that.
Whether Trump is still skeptical of the agencies is hard to say. A few hours before the hearing, he said in a tweet that he's a big fan of intelligence. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Environmental groups and the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency have reached an agreement that settles one of two active lawsuits aimed at forcing the agency to take overdue action on Fairbanks' North Pole area air quality. Localized but extreme wintertime episodes of fine particulate pollution due to wood and fossil fuel burning emissions have long plagued the two communities. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, clean air advocates see the legal action as a small win in a long-running effort to reduce pollution.
Under a court-approved consent decree agreed to by the environmental groups and the EPA, the agency must issue an assessment by the end of August 2017 of the adequacy of a state implementation plan, which lays out measures to reduce Fairbanks and North Pole area fine particulate pollution. The agreement essentially prompts overdue action required under the Clean Air Act.
I'm happy that we're moving towards compliance with the Clean Air Act. Short-term and long-term, both for the sake of our health and for our economy.
That's Patrice Lee with Fairbanks-based Citizens for Clean Air, which together with Alaska Community Action on Toxics brought the suit. The group's attorney, Kent Asuda with Earth Justice, says another consent decree still in the public comment phase would resolve a second lawsuit.
And that's addressing EPA's inaction under the Clean Air Act with respect to the determination of meeting attainment dates for cleaning up the air, and if it fails to do so, reclassification as a serious non-attainment area.
Reclassification as serious would require a new state plan to address Fairbanks North Pole area pollution. It would likely build on current plan measures like burn bans and a requirement that only dry wood is burned in wood stoves and boilers. Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation Division of Air Quality Director Denise Koch says the state and Fairbanks North Star Borough will have to recraft the technical document by a December 2017 EPA deadline.
It was going to be really tough to submit that on time because public process is a very important part and not a part that we are going to shortchange in any way. So it's going to be a big challenge.
Failure to get the plan in on time can result in sanctions, including impacts to federal transportation funding. One other moving part in the local air quality puzzle is a state proposal requesting EPA consider Fairbanks and North Pole air separately. It's inspired by very differing trends. Fairbanks is close to meeting federal standards, while North Pole suffers the worst particulate spikes in the nation. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
For decades, the village of King Cove on the Alaska Peninsula has sought to build an 11-mile road to an all-weather airstrip in Cold Bay. It would cut through ecologically sensitive habitat protected by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The Obama administration denied a land swap that was proposed in 2013. With a new administration, though, and the backing of Alaska's congressional delegation, King Cove has renewed hope they'll get their road. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
When Alaska Congressman Don Young was sworn in for his 23rd term in the House of Representatives on Tuesday, he quickly introduced 38 pieces of legislation. Among them is a bill to build the King Cove Road.
Which I've just talked to the Secretary Zinke, and I think we can do that administratively, but I've introduced a bill.
King Cove residents have been fighting for a road to Cold Bay for the past 40 years. In 2013, former Interior Secretary Sally Jewell ruled against the proposed 11-mile road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. With President-elect Trump's new Interior Secretary pick, Montana Representative Ryan Zinke, King Cove residents have renewed hope that they will get a road from their remote village to the all-weather airport in Cold Bay. Della Trumbull, a spokesperson for the King Cove Corporation, says safety is the key reason proponents have fought so long for this road.
First and foremost is safe access in times of emergencies, and this, usually in this case it's normally medical emergencies. And other than that, it's just basically on a day-to-day basis is safe access between the communities at King Cove and Cold Bay.
When weather is extreme, planes can't get in or out of King Cove. In the past year, 17 people were medically evacuated, three by the U.S. Coast Guard. Opponents to the land swap and road construction say that it would damage sensitive wildlife habitat. They say that a road through the congressionally delegated Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge could harm species, such as Pacific brant, emperor geese, Steller's eiders, tundra swans, and sea lions. What King Cove's lobbying strategy with a new Interior Secretary will be, Trumbull won't yet say. She does say, though, that the village is optimistic and that decades into this fight, they don't plan to give up anytime soon. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
U.S. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan today introduced a bill to open up a portion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge for oil and gas drilling. For decades, Alaska politicians have pushed to allow development in the refuge's coastal plain. But with Donald Trump taking the White House this month and a Republican-led Congress, the latest bill may gain more traction. In a joint news release, the senators say the Alaska Oil and Gas Production Act would allow development on 2,000 surface acres within the refuge's coastal plain, also known as the 1002 area. On the House side, Alaska Congressman Don Young introduced a bill to open a portion of the refuge for development on Tuesday. Environmental groups opposed the effort, citing potential impacts to wildlife and subsistence hunting. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, could a dam in Cake be the key to unlocking new hydroelectric energy?
As far as I know, it's the lowest hanging fruit in the state, and perhaps even the nation.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
There's been more turnover at the top level of Juno's daily newspaper. Publisher Rustin Barton has left the Juno Empire after nearly 4 years at the helm, according to a brief article posted Wednesday afternoon on the newspaper's website. His departure follows the managing editor and two reporters in recent weeks. Top editor Charles Westmoreland left at the end of December after 5 years at the paper, and reporters Lisa Fu and Sam DeGrave also left at the end of last month. The Juno Empire article gave no reason for the publisher's departure, although it did say he'd left to take an unspecified job in the Midwest. Burton said he was on a family vacation and declined further comment. Deputy editor Emily Russo Miller has been serving as interim managing editor since Christmas Eve, and a reporter started earlier this week. The Juno Empire is owned by Georgia-based Morris Communications. The article posted to their site said Kenai-based group publisher Dee Dee McKenzie will serve as the publisher in the interim. A multi-million dollar dam in Cake would make it easier to bring renewable energy to the village, which currently runs off diesel. But the definition of renewable isn't the same in everyone's book. Federal grants for hydro projects can be limited compared to what's available for wind and solar. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins reports.
Jody Mitchell puts up a different kind of inspo in her Juno office.
Diesel emits 22.384 pounds of CO2 into the atmosphere.
I see that's on your computer on a sticky note.
Yeah, I write that there to remind myself every day of why we're doing this.
Mitchell is the CEO of the Inside Passage Electric Cooperative, a nonprofit that supplies energy to small Southeast communities. She says sometimes the only way to power remote Alaska is by burning diesel. And as her yellow sticky note attests, she thinks there's a better way.
If I could build a hydro project in each of those communities, even if it wouldn't cover the full load, at least they'd have some energy security.
But Mitchell says building a hydro project from scratch can be expensive, and the permitting can take a long time. About 3 years ago, Mitchell says the utility was getting close to completing a hydro project in Huna, and the village of Cake was next on the list. So they sent out a couple of engineers to scope it out.
I was surprised. I was shocked when they sent me the pictures. I was like, where are you? And they're like, we're at Gunnett Creek. There's a dam here already, Jody.
What the engineers discovered was a $12 million tank and dam that was supposed to be used for Cake's drinking water. Mitchell says it was built around 2006, using mostly federal funds, but its electric pumps made it too pricey for the village to operate. And what makes this unused dam special is it can generate electricity.
As far as I know, it's the lowest hanging fruit in the state, and perhaps even the nation.
The U.S. Department of Energy sees untapped potential nationwide for retrofitting non-power generating dams. Mitchell thinks this one could be done for about $6 million and would supply more than half of Cake's electricity. In the past, she says the utility would have relied on the Renewable Energy Fund, a state program. But because of Alaska's mega budget deficit, that funding has gone away. Loans aren't out of the question. Still, that's an expense that could be passed on to ratepayers, something that Mitchell says she doesn't want to do. So what options are left?
Most of the projects, or most of the grant funds that are available through the federal government, do not include hydro. And, you know, anyone who lives in Southeast Alaska thinks that that's completely bonkers.
Jeff Leahy, the deputy executive director of the National Hydropower Association, says that's partly true, but it's more complicated.
Do people recognize that hydropower is a renewable resource? Yes, they do believe that at the federal level, but sometimes they have not included hydropower in the definition of renewable energy.
Leahy thinks that's why there aren't more federal grants for hydro projects. There isn't consistency across the different federal agencies. Senator Lisa Murkowski was working on a bill that would have made that definition more clear, potentially opening up more federal grants for hydro. But Congress ran out of time. And Leahy says, at least anecdotally, solar and wind seem to get all of the attention.
I think some of that comes back to the misconception that the real growth in renewables could only come from wind and solar technologies, and that hydro, the myth about hydro is that it was all built out and that there were no new opportunities available for growth.
Back at the office of the Inside Passage Electric Cooperative, Joni Mitchell reads me a letter.
Your project was not one of the highest ranked projects selected for funding at this time.
A rejection letter. It's from the United States Department of Agriculture, one of a handful of federal grant opportunities that includes hydro.
You know, I do a lot of crying when I'm alone because I want it so bad. I want so bad to help my people.
Mitchell still thinks Cake's best bet for cheaper electricity is retrofitting its existing dam. She'll try to reapply in the next grant cycle, but she'd like to see the floodgates opened on more federal funding. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
On New Year's Day, a car was stolen in Anchorage. It was a silver Nissan Sentra with dice on the rearview mirror, according to a release sent out around 5:30 that evening from the Anchorage Police Department. Also inside was a 3-year-old girl, information that wasn't sent out to the public for another 40 minutes. During that time, police were verifying information to put out an Amber Alert, an official process followed by the state under federal guidelines for broadcasting messages over the airwaves, mobile phones, and the internet to let the public know when a child has been abducted and could be in danger. Renee Oystadt is a public information officer for APD and says the delay was the result of police verifying all the information coming in at the same time.
It's par for the course. It feels like a long time for people who aren't involved. But if you're actually involved in the situation, there are a lot of moving parts. There's a lot going on. We actually got the information out fairly quickly.
Within a few minutes of the Nixle release, just as APD was getting ready to activate an Amber Alert, the car was discovered.
So the citizen who saw the vehicle thought it looked out of place, physically looked in the car, saw the child strapped inside, and called police. That particular individual had not actually received the Nix Alert, isn't signed up for them, so didn't know that we were looking for a car or a missing child.
Alaska has only had 6 Amber Alerts in the last 2 decades, and the protocols for issuing one are clearly laid out in state guidelines. An official checklist for law enforcement is used to verify whether a case meets the Amber Alert criteria, asking whether there's the threat of harm, whether the victim is a minor, and whether or not a description is available. Because the alerts are treated so seriously, law enforcement has a high threshold for issuing them to make sure broadcasters and the public don't get overly accustomed.
Well, any delays we see in the activation of an Amber Alert are not due to the process that's in place.
Lieutenant Stephen Adams coordinates the state's Amber Alert system and says emailing or faxing the materials to the state trooper dispatch center in Fairbanks isn't time sensitive, but getting accurate information can be.
The most significant delay we'll ever see with the activation of an Amber Alert is the officer being able to interview witnesses, take information from complainants, getting statements from those witnesses on what they saw. That's the biggest delay in the activation of an Amber Alert.
According to a spokesperson for the Department of Public Safety, the state's last Amber Alert was issued in 2015.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
Alaska's namesake airline launched its new daily flight from the West Coast to Havana this morning. Alaska Airlines' new service comes as the Obama administration's opening to Cuba gives way to an uncertain future. Northwest News Network correspondent Tom Bonzi reports.
U.S. Airlines competed aggressively last year for a limited number of slots to begin regular scheduled service to Cuba. Alaska Airlines won the only West Coast route awarded, a daily round trip that starts in Seattle, goes to Los Angeles, and then onward to Havana and back. But will the incoming Trump administration change the rules?
Tom, your guess is as good as mine at this point,
says Alaska Airlines VP of Capacity Planning, John Kirby.
Obviously, there's always the potential that things could change, but since services started, it's difficult to envision us taking a big step backwards.
The Obama administration loosened restrictions on travel from the U.S. to Cuba, but visits simply for tourism remain illegal. U.S. travelers need to have family ties, official business, or an educational, religious, or humanitarian agenda. I'm Tom Bonsi reporting.
This year's flu season is off to a mild start, though there was an uptick in cases reported nationwide and in Alaska during the last 2 weeks of the year. Dr. Jay Butler is Alaska's chief medical officer.
It's not been a terrible year for flu. We began to see an increase in influenza-like illness in October. Now, at the same time, there are other respiratory viruses that are circulating, so there's no lack of cough out in the community. But so far, it's been fairly mild for influenza.
For the past two seasons, the flu vaccine is not proven as effective as health officials would like, but Dr. Butler says this year's seems to be doing a better job.
The vaccine has a good match this year with the isolates that have been obtained in the United States, so we're much more optimistic that we'll have a good vaccine effectiveness this year.
Last year's flu peaked late in the U.S., including in Alaska, with the highest number of cases reported in March and early April. Dr. Butler says it's not too late to get vaccinated this season.
Because of the remote location, sometimes influenza can reach our villages a little later than other parts of Alaska or the lower 48. So it's important to keep in mind that sometimes flu activity doesn't peak until fairly late in the winter.
The U.S. Centers for Disease Control recommends everyone over the age of 6 months get a flu shot. The nasal flu vaccine used last year is no longer recommended. The nasal vaccine ended up offering no protection for children aged 2 to 17 years old, although the CDC says it's not yet sure why that might be. Each year, millions of Americans catch the flu, hundreds of thousands are hospitalized, and thousands tend to die from it. Wrangell may see a new senior and assisted living facility come to fruition this year. The 16-bedroom Old Sourdough Lodge, a 36-year-old bed and breakfast, is under new ownership and is being converted to a house to house Wrangell's seniors. KSDK's Aaron Bolton has more.
Shannon Bosdell and Daniel Blake purchased the Old Sourdough Lodge in late December. The new facility will be named Harbor House. Bosdell, who previously owned and managed assisted living facilities for 15 years, moved to Wrangell 4 years ago to retire, but started contemplating the idea of starting the operation after he saw the need.
When I saw there was such a need, there wasn't something like this here, or not even the real assisted living outside of a hospital setting. So when I heard this place was for sale, came over here, and I was like, this is perfect. This is all one level, easy access to the rooms. I can do a great mix of the senior living through assisted living type care.
Harbor House is taking reservations now, and it's planned to open in April. The 15,000-square-foot facility will offer 16 rooms, 5 for assisted living. Bosdell and Blake still need to go through the state licensing process, which is based on how many clients are served. A doctor's recommendation is needed for seniors that wish to receive assisted care. Bosdell added that hospice care will also be available to Harbor House's residents.
And that's what I want it to be, is their home. And kind of with this design, you know, they could be in this room for 15 years, you know, from time I'm perfectly happy, walkie-talkie, all the way through hospice, all within one room and not have to be moved around to different facilities.
There will also be a restaurant-style kitchen serving different meal options three times a day, 24-hour nursing and CNA staff, and a 2,000-square-foot recreation area.
Anything from exercise classes, movie nights, outings, you know, take trips out the road, take drives, and even considering doing fishing trips for them. I've done that with other homes. That really was a big hit, and people really enjoyed that.
The Planning and Zoning Commission will consider a conditional use permit for the building's conversion next Thursday. The area is currently zoned as light industrial. Wrangell has been in need of senior and assisted living and is home to the second oldest population in the state. Wrangell's local tribe, Wrangell Cooperative Association, is also seeking to build a senior living facility. Currently, the Wrangell Medical Center offers 14 beds for long-term care. Medical Center CEO Robert Rang says the facility was full through 2016, and several former Wrangell residents who have gone elsewhere for care are on an informal waiting list. Wrangell also has one unassisted senior apartment complex and a volunteer non-medical hospice care group. The Sourdough Lodge was built in 1984. Previous owners Bruce and Darlene Harding took over the lodge from family in 1990. The lodge has been for sale over the past year. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
An active Alaska volcano has erupted again, this time sending a cloud of ash and ice 35,000 feet into the air. The Alaska Volcano Observatory says the explosion from Bogoslav Volcano in the Aleutian Islands happened today and lasted about 5 minutes. Observatory geophysicist Dave Schneider says there have been more than 10 eruptions since mid-December. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. Weird reports tonight from Elizabeth Jenkins and Jacob Resnick in Juneau, Avery Lill in Dillingham, Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., and Tom Bonzi in Portland, Oregon. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I am Zachariah Hughes. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Anchorage and Fairbanks to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. If you're a rural Alaska resident, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, February 3, 2017. Applicants with knowledge of regional subsistence uses, customs, and traditions are needed. Council meetings serve as a forum for subsistence management. More at 1-800-478-1456. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.